Welcome to We Are JP's Looking Upstream, a conversational podcast of community, humanness, and well-being rooted in JP County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams, and today I'm talking with John Prey and Ken Matthews. As you'll hear me say to the guys at the top of the conversation, I'm approaching this one a little differently, and I'm trying to exercise some different muscles as a show host conversationalist. If you've seen We Are JP's documentary, A Home in Paradise, which premiered at the Salida Film Festival in May, you will recognize Ken as one of the voices who is lending his perspectives on housing affordability to that film. You also might recognize his voice from a radio show that he hosted for several years at KHN 106.9 FM Community Radio in Salida called the Chafee Housing Report. What you might not realize is that John was behind the scenes for the Housing Report for all those years, as he often is for this show. John is an engineer handling the tech side of our recording here at the station, and today I asked the wizard, so to speak, to step out from behind the curtain and join in with me and Ken. I think it's a fun one. They both have stories, like John's experience of interviewing Mick Jagger back in the day, and that time he was on the radio mic covering a clash between the Black Panthers and riot police as they, well, as John puts it, beat the hell out of each other. Actually, John dug up a news link from that event, and I've included it in the episode show notes on our website if you want to see photos. We also talk about Ken's rugby playing days and his ongoing enthusiasm for the sport. We talk about his green thumb and his advocacy for affordable housing. We talk about the agrarian interests of both their fathers, which brings up the Depression and the Dust Bowl, among other things. And related to that, I have a pseudo-correction to make. You'll hear me reference Jonathan Rabin's book, Bad Land. It's possible that I was conflating that with Timothy Egan's book, The Worst Hard Time. Both are good, as I recall, and worth the read. The Looking Upstream podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority. Show notes with links and a full transcript of this and all Looking Upstream conversations are available at wearechafee.org. Okay, here we go. Ken Matthews, John Prey.
Thanks for joining me, guys. I'm going to let you in on my plan here, which is I don't have one. And part of the thing for that is because I always have one. I always come in with pages of typed notes, thoughts, the research, the everything I've done. I've met with guests for coffee or something beforehand. And I kind of wanted to test myself on being able to be just a bit lighter and freer with it, and I thought you guys would be good for joining me for this. So thanks for being here. Thanks for showing up. Thanks for trusting me, even though I didn't have any plans communicated to you.
No worries. You know, I know about putting all those notes together and everything, and that sometimes they become restrictive. You know, you kind of decide where you're going, and I've been on your side of the interview thing many times on the Chafee Housing Report. And you kind of get tied to them, and I think it takes some spontaneity away.
I like to think that I provide that as structure with a lot of freedom for organic flow or whatever in it, and I never know, you know, what's going to come up, so I can ask a follow-up question that leads down some path I could not have predicted. And yeah, there still is, but I want to get to these key points and these key things that, you know, in my mind, it's about making it an impactful, valuable thing for listeners. And I feel like if I was a freer, maybe more extroverted, sort of gregarious person, I could come in here, be fun and entertaining and light and laugh a ton, and we wouldn't necessarily get into the deep and meaningful, vulnerable things, and it would just be a totally different show, but that's not who I am. And I'm kind of testing out a little bit with that today, like I said. So, John, I also want you to be on the mic with us today because you're the guy who's behind the scenes. You were for several years with Ken on the Housing Report. You have been for 2 years now with me on Looking Upstream. And I want people to know something about each of you, actually, a little more than they might otherwise know. And I want personally to get to know more about you guys. So, John, I want to hear a little bit about your history with radio because I just know a couple of things about you. One is retired, I think, communications professor from Marquette. Is that right?
Sure, that's right.
You can fix up the language however it needs to be.
Yeah, it's close enough.
And a nugget of a story that you mentioned almost in passing, it just sort of came out one day. Were you a college student at the college radio station when you interviewed Mick Jagger from the Stones?
Yeah.
When was this? The 60s?
69, yeah. They were coming through on a pre-tour performance at Moby Gym, which is Colorado State's auditorium, essentially. I can't remember the date exactly, but 1969, and I won the lottery to get a free ticket in the press box with then Jody Wheezy, who was the editor of the campus newspaper. And, you know, had a good time, took some good pictures. But, yeah, so I got my start in campus radio at Colorado State. KCSU-FM 107.9 was about 10 times more powerful than this station. You know, got to be news director, finally went pro. Did a little work in Denver for a couple of years. Finally went back to college because nobody gets paid nothing in radio. So the comical part of this is Cahen is populated in large part by senior volunteers. I mean, they may not sound senior, although some do. And as a result, I've kind of taken to calling it college radio for senior citizens. It should be an activity from the bus pulling up.
Well, don't skip past the Jagger thing. I mean, we're talking in the 60s when, really? I mean, I don't know if you can pinpoint a heyday for the Stones. They've been going for 100 years, but the 60s feels like a pretty strong point with some of their classics for sure. What was that like? What's that story?
Well, you know, we got to him as a collective from campus media, which would have been yearbook, newspaper, radio station, and got him to agree to sit down with us for half an hour, which turned into 45 minutes. I had the Wallensack reel-to-reel tape recorder so I could document the thing. And, you know, there were three of us on one of him, and he was sort of conscious. I mean, he was under the influence of, I'm not sure what, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
I wasn't sure what you meant by sort of conscious. If we're talking about with enlightenment, spirituality, if he was high. Okay.
No, he was high. He was high. He might have been drunk and high. You know, pretty entertaining guy, but clearly slurring his words badly. And I was going to take this and edit it into a little interview and put it on the air later. Here's us talking to Mick Jagger. And he almost needed subtitles, which, you know, never got around to. So somewhere in a trunk in my attic is still a reel-to-reel of Mick Jagger at 7.5 inches per second.
I think we ought to get that out of the trunk, probably, put it together, put it out somewhere.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. I mean, that's 50-some years ago-ish. More than that.
Was that the highlight of your, at the time, very young career, right? But, I mean, how long is that the benchmark for, I talked with Mick Jagger?
Oh, you know, that was a highlight, no doubt. I had a number of them. I was also news director for the campus station. And as such, was generally embraced by student groups, campus populations, and I got into Board of Trustees meetings, and I got into Students for a Democratic Society, and I got into Black Panther meetings, and, you know, made a lot of friends and got into a lot of closed doors.
Now I want to hear about that. Can I want to get to you, because I've
hey,
got
man,
something.
I don't have anything like that. I've been, so.
Well, I'm sure we have some interesting things for us to talk about, too. And I actually, let me go ahead and say, I would love if this ends up turning into more of a triangular thing, as if we're having coffee, having a drink, whatever. But I am such a curious guy that I always have questions. So, Black Panthers, what? Tell me something about some experience,
you know,
there.
That or Students for a Democratic Society. Black Panther's most notable experience was they were protesting our basketball team playing Brigham Young University.
Okay.
We were both in whatever conference that was at the time.
Western Athletic Conference.
Yeah. Thank you.
What, and tell me again, what university are we talking about?
Where this is were? Colorado State.
Okay.
In Fort Collins.
What was the protest against playing BYU?
BYU, they perceived to be a racist institution because there were no priests in the Mormon church who were of color. And they got themselves organized and worked into a lather, and about halfway through the, about a halftime of the basketball game, the Black Panthers, Black Student Association, BSA, marched out onto the court. And from the other end of Moby Gym, the arena marches phalanx of Fort Collins stormtroopers. I mean, these guys were dressed up with batons and helmets and the whole nine yards. And, you know, both sides knew the other side was coming, and I had been advertised as doing commentary for the riot in the campus newspaper. Those were the days. And, you know, they went into the middle of the floor and beat the hell out of each other. It was, you know, the
better than the basketball game.
Police clearly won that.
I'm speechless. Like, not only that this is happening, but that it's so forecasted that you could essentially be promoted as the guy providing commentary for the riot,
in the
battle,
yeah.
Protest.
Right. Hope they didn't expect any color commentary out of me for the basketball game because I had nothing to offer.
Do you remember how that got resolved and a basketball game returned? Or did they just say, nope, go your separate ways, we're done?
They cleared the floor and finished the game. Campus administration promised to look further into the matter and sent three of us. God, I can remember the guy's face. I can't remember his name. Big guy. As an ambassador, the campus student body president, and me as the journalist to Brigham Young to see if it really was a racist institution. And I don't think they really were. It was just another world, another time.
Is that something they're going to say, well, you got that right? Sure we are. I mean, even then, are they really going to say that?
No, they're not going to say that. Yeah, but, you know, BYU for years was pretty lily white in their athletic programs. I'm a little younger than John, not much, year or so. And, you know, I went to the University of Oklahoma, which was the first college in the Midwest to integrate their football team. Now, not while I was there. That was a guy named Prentice Gaunt way back in the 50s. And BYU, we used to say that BYU decided to integrate their football team when they needed running backs and they needed some speed, you know. And they
That's probably how a lot of universities did it, right? Was based on we see somebody with ability. We're going to make an excuse or an exception to our racist policies and let it in.
Yeah, they wanted to win football games.
Yeah,
they wanted to win basketball games, and you know, of course, I think that was accompanied by. You know, some sort of official proclamation from the church that, you know, they were going to start ministering to, you know, different populations. They've for years recruited among the Polynesian communities, you know, in terms of ministering to them. And if you look at their football teams, they've got some massive Tongan boys, you know, out there playing now. So it's completely integrated now, but I don't know what that means in terms of the church's involvement or anything like that, or if it changes any of the policies that they had before then. I'm not Latter-day Saint, you know, so
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, I think ultimately they had a revelation that they should probably allow people of color into the priesthood. And I'm not sure that resolved all of the racial issues, but was a step in the right direction. And like you, I'm not a student of it anymore, but it was interesting. Boy, it was a nice campus in a nice setting. And this big black guy, Rayford Tillis was his name. I could tell you some Rayford stories too, but I won't. he was probably 6'6", you know, was maybe a backup on the basketball team, as I recall. And boy, the people just clustered around him like he was a rock star. And he'd be taking questions and answering questions, and just it was a fascinating ritual to watch. But yeah, that was campus radio, not to wander too far afield, but there were some of those highlights.
Ken, you have some athletic background. I understand that you played rugby.
Yeah, I started playing rugby at 18. I was at a community college near an Army base, Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And they had a exchange officer, a major named Mike Girdlestone. And he was from there, West Point. He was the Fort Sill was the field artillery school for the United States Army, so they got a lot of foreign students there too. And Mike was there, and he was a rugby player, and he wanted to play rugby, so he started a rugby team. I'd played basketball in high school, and that summer I was a lifeguard at the Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge, which was a great job. And there was a player there from either Montana or Montana State who had played. And he goes, "Hey, they're starting this rugby team. Let's go out." And so we went out, and that's how I started.
When you were playing rugby, are we saying on what official team? What's the capacity when they were starting a team?
It was called the Fort Sill Gunners. You know, it was anybody that enlisted or officers who wanted to show up, and there's a number of civilians went out and played with them.
To be clear, were you a civilian, or were you saying you were in the Army?
No, I was a civilian. I was going to a local community college.
Okay.
And Cameron University is the name of it. And I made the first team. I'd seen rugby one time, a wide world of sports.
Okay.
You remember those?
Yeah.
You get little clips of games. And I said, "Wow, that's a cool looking sport. I'd like to play it." And basketball actually was a pretty good entree to it. We always played sandlot football, so you're tackling without pads. And so I was used to doing that. And in basketball, you learn to attack space. In rugby, you learn to attack space.
I never thought about it that way. I also was a basketball player, and I touched rugby very thinly once when I was in the Army. Coincidentally, I was in San Angelo, Texas at the time, and it was a casual recreational thing, and I went there just a handful of times. I wasn't in town very long. I was only there about 6 months, and I've never played rugby since, but I got to learn some of the basics of the rules at the time, and we're talking maybe close to 25 years ago. You went on and, I mean, I think have more of a relationship or more of a passion or something for it.
Yeah, right? I did. I went through college. I then transferred to the University of Oklahoma. They didn't have a rugby team, so I went back and still played for Fort Sill occasionally. And then I got in the Army and was assigned. I was a lieutenant in the Army at Fort Carson. And Colorado Springs had a team, so I played 3 years there. And then I went back to law school at the University of Oklahoma, did 3 years and played there on the club side there at OU. And then I came back to Colorado Springs, played there, went to Denver, played for the Denver Barbarians, who were a really big club.
What does that mean to be a club team for Denver? I mean, are we saying – were there multiple teams within Denver, or did you travel?
There were multiple teams within Denver, probably five or six at one point in time, and then all the colleges had them. So there was – you just played whoever you wanted to play. It wasn't structured when I was playing at – when I was at University of Oklahoma. There were four teams in the state. There was University of Oklahoma, OSU – Oklahoma City had a club side, Tulsa had a club side, Fort Sill had it, so there were five. And we would go down to Texas and play quite a bit, or we'd go to Kansas, we'd go to Arkansas. We went to Monterey, played in the Monterey tournament 1 year. We traveled a lot.
In California?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was played on Pebble Beach.
Yeah. Wow. I was there too. And that also was with the Army. I feel like we have some interweaving sorts of ideas here. We could go down any one of these rabbit holes, but I'm curious more, I guess, for the rugby thing. With obviously you put a number of years into this, it's a commitment to these clubs. What is it that really stokes a fire for you about it?
Well, I like the competition. I like the camaraderie. There was one thing about rugby players, they play hard and they party hard. You know, that's part of it. Mine was more focused on the playing. I really enjoyed the competition. I played a position that was I played scrum half, which is the guy that puts the ball in the scrum. When it comes out, you either pass it, run it, or kick it. So it's a very active position. You're commanding the forwards, the guys in the scrum. You're telling them what to do. And I liked that, you know. And it was just I think by the time I was a practicing attorney, it was a very good way for me to blow off steam.
Okay.
You know, in a stressful profession and like that. And then I coached, and I coached, I refereed after I quit playing, and administrated clubs. I administrated the Denver Barbarians, who were in the Super League at that time. So were the 16 teams around the country that played they flew to California all the time. So you're administrating, how do we get, you know, 27 people to where's the money coming from?
Just, and all the logistics of flights and food and lodging and all the things. And
vans on the hotels and all that.
The typical person that you encounter, do they have any idea about rugby? Do you feel like at this point? Like, is it one of those sort of subculture, sub-sport type things?
Well, it definitely has been most of my life. You know, there's a professional league in the U.S. now called the Major League Soccer. I mean, I'm sorry, Major League Rugby. And it's all over the country. And it's well-financed. It's still not the level of European rugby or South Africa or New Zealand or Australia or Fiji, those countries. But it's I think, the first time the U.S. has had an opportunity to be able to develop players at a higher level. They're getting paid, so they train every day. They're coached well. And the World Cup, not the next one, but the following one, Men's World Cup, is in the United States.
Where?
Well, it's going to be all over the country.
Oh, okay.
You know, because it's going to have 24 teams from all over the world, and they'll be headquartered in different places. I'm sure California will be one. I'm sure something on the East Coast, probably something around Chicago or the Midwest.
Yeah, try to maximize exposure for accessibility for people.
Yeah, but it will be a huge tourist thing. People from all over the world will come. I've been to two World Cups.
Where?
I went to the World Cup that's hosted by Wales in 1999, but it was actually held in Ireland, Wales, England, and France. And I saw matches only in England and Wales. And then I went to the last World Cup, which was 2013, which was hosted by France. And I saw only one match in Nice, France, between Scotland and Tonga.
Okay. John, what's your take on rugby?
I now know more about it than I did before I met Ken.
Whether he wanted to or not.
You guys have known each other several years, right? From working together at radio and socially.
Yeah, close to 10 years, I'd say.
Yeah, 7, 8 maybe.
Yeah,
since I moved out here. We got started the same day, you know, doing a program on housing. Not to change the subject, but that's a pivot.
Let's roll with wherever it goes.
You know, and Ken had his written out proposal about the type of show he wanted to produce, and I walked in off the street capable of doing that sort of thing. So I said, yeah, I'd like to work with him. And, you know, the rest is history. You know, we talked to a lot of really interesting people who I still meet on the street, as I do many of your guests. And I greet them like I know them. And I've always been just kind of the guy on the other side of the board.
Do they recognize you?
Yeah, sometimes.
if they were repeat people, I'm sure they recognize John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it would be somebody that maybe just came in once or twice, you know, once probably. But, you know, John's a memorable guy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, very personable. You're Chatty. Always the first to greet him and go through things. I mean, It's my jokes and whatnot, some laughs, and
it's my job.
Sociability.
You know, John's always been. He's got the radio voice. I mean, you just listen to him. It's more than he's ever been heard on my show, but. He's really good on the radio, but he's chosen in this case to, with me and with you, to be behind the scenes and utilize those skills.
Well, my other option would have been to do a shift here as a DJ, and that's still an option, I suspect. But I did that for so long in college and as a pro that I just don't have the – you know, the excitement about it anymore. And the musical selection I would turn to is my stuff from the 60s and 70s. And, like, this station doesn't have enough DJs playing stuff from the 60s and 70s. If you can get away with a day without Led Zeppelin, it's a, it's a rare day at Cahen.
What would you say? This was a college radio station for senior citizens?
For senior citizens, exactly.
So you're all playing from pretty similar era.
Yeah. You know, there is a theory that the music taste you have currently is determined between the ages of, you know, 14 and 21 or 22 or something like that. So for the, you know, the notion of me ever getting into Flock of Seagulls or, you know, there were some notable exceptions to that. But, you know, I can talk to my kid who grew up in the 80s and 90s. Entirely different musical taste. Not bad stuff, just entirely different.
I almost didn't get out of the truck to come in here because Guns N' Roses' November Rain was on the radio, and I didn't want to stop listening, and it's a long song.
Yeah. You listen to it on, you know, some streaming service.
Yeah.
Get your fill of it.
So I'm not interested in hearing that as much as I do or playing that as much as it gets played around here. I'm trying to expand into new stuff, and it's hard to do. Tough to find somebody you like. I mean, I'm going to see a Talking Heads cover band here over the weekend. And
out of Texas.
Is that out of
Texas?
Yeah,
they're out of Texas. Yeah. That seems to be a huge disconnect for me, Talking Heads cover Texas. Band out of Texas.
When you went pro, John, are you saying that it was with the news side of things? Was it music as a DJ? Did you maybe have a run of both somewhere in there?
Yeah, you know, I went to Denver to read news at KOA, a 50,000-watt Voice of the West radio station. And my first day reading news there, and it wasn't I was even writing it, it was people would just hand me copy. And I always had sort of a knack for reading out loud and recognizing odd words and being able to pronounce them. But about 30 seconds before I was supposed to go live my first time, the guy who was my boss stuck his head in and said, "Don't worry about it. Your potential listening audience is only about 40 million people." Because it went all the way from Canada to Mexico in those days. And I did not, as a, I think, 19-year-old, need to hear that. So I read news for a couple of summers and then went back to school and went to work for a local radio station up there, being both news and DJ guy, and had some adventures there as well. I mean, you know, plane crashes, auto crashes, death and destruction. It's a much different news environment than campus radio.
Yeah.
The college news is different. So, you know, got out of that.
Did you ever watch WKRP in Cincinnati?
Oh, you bet. Yeah. I actually, there was a guy at KCSU-FM who wrote that show, Tom Chihak, retired, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But I think the Turkey Drop episode was his. Just.
Okay.
And could have theoretically been based on some small part about life in the campus station, which was different in the 60s and 70s. If you think Mick was off his game, many a day there would be stone DJs.
He was probably not the only one in the room who was.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah.
I won't ask you specifically, even though I'm sure the statute of limitations has passed, as it can.
Oh, yeah.
No, I was quite sober that day.
John, I want to ask you, since you guys know each other so well, and this is going to be turned around the other direction, what is something in Ken's story, something interesting about him that I won't know and that you can out on him right now that, you know, I guess you can see how risky you want to be with that in the friendship, but I figure you can help me know something about Ken, and Ken, it'll go vice versa here with John, just something compelling about
each
other.
You know, he is surprisingly sensitive for being such a, you know, burly ex-rugby player.
Not burly anymore.
Well, used to be. You used to be burlier.
Yes. Does the mentality of burly ever leave if you've been a rough and tumble rugby player?
Well, I wasn't big enough to be like that. I had to be a skillful, quick player, you know, even at 195 pounds, you know.
But there's a certain aggressiveness.
Yeah, you had to be very aggressive about it, yeah.
Well, but I mean, even to this day, you'd probably punch somebody in the face after an argument.
No, not me. I would not do that.
I could be confusing you with someone else.
I'd hurt my hand.
Who could that be?
I would not do that. I have better conflict resolution skills now than I did when I was younger.
And you're still involved with conflict resolution?
No, not. I was the chair of Full Circle Restorative Justice, which is an organization here in this county for many years, but I...
Yeah, and we've talked with Eric Lee, who's now director of that.
He's an amazing – that's the biggest success of, I think, while I was chair, is finding Eric. He found us, really, and we just had to have the sense to go, wow, this guy's something. And
he's a keeper.
Oh, yeah.
He's got an incredible story, incredible resume.
I've listened to his interview
on the podcast, and – I think maybe it sounds kind of serendipitous that you both found each other then.
Yeah, I mean, he reached out. He found us in a roundabout way, and we had another really good candidate too, and Eric was just something. It is something.
His story on it is that it took two or three times for people pointing out this possibility and opportunity here to him, and like for him to kind of feel like there's something clicking and calling him to it.
I think his daughter was prodding him, and he had started in doing some restorative practices work in Denver.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it had a sister-in-law up here, and so they liked this area, and I think that those two things combined was kind of a no-brainer for him in terms of where he wanted to go next in his life.
I think it's so interesting when things come together and just such a perfect match.
Yeah, it's very serendipitous sometimes. I know that word sounds kind of flippant, but I don't mean it that way.
I actually already used it so for this. I mean, yeah, I said it a moment ago. I see
sorry,
it that
I
way.
Hear.
No. I'm just, we're on the same page. I'm a copycat. We're on the same page.
Kismet. It would be more kismet in your case.
Would it?
Yeah.
I don't know that word.
That's serendipity.
I was creating the space for it to be okay that you said it.
Okay.
Because you said it could be flippant. I'm like, well, then I guess we both are, because I think it... It's a good word. John.
So Ken, I was going to finish the story, is an avid gardener. And, you know, I came from an agrarian background, but can't keep up with this guy. Of course, he's got land, but he's also got a greenhouse that's full of succulents.
Succulents and cactus.
Yeah.
Hundreds of them.
Is that a phase you're going through?
I don't think so. I think it's probably, if it is, I think it's probably the last phase.
It's a new lifestyle. Well, I've been through phases which were mostly driven by my father. And whatever he was into at the moment, I would receive bulbs as, you know, birthday presents by and large. And he would buy iris bulbs. And I don't know if you're into iris, but if you get into iris.
Very nice.
I don't know anything about it.
Very expensive. And he would send me just these remarkable bulbs.
This when you're in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know.
So it's a good environment for them, too.
They'd multiply, and you'd have to divide them and share them with friends. And then he got into daylilies.
Where was he?
He was in Colorado.
Is that where you were from?
Yeah, Denver. Yeah, I grew up in Denver.
Okay.
You know, he was originally a Kansas farm boy, having survived the Dust Bowl, essentially. So when he moved to the city and got a city job, he was, boy, he had a big garden. we would get to turn it over every spring, my brother and I, and didn't look
using
so
good. A turning fork.
Fork,
yeah.
And then if once wasn't enough, he'd say, "Why don't you go double ditch that thing?" Anyway, so Ken's quite the gardener. If you were to see his property, it's spectacular. You know.
Thank you, John.
I can hear you blush over there, but it shows. You
know, well, it's so interesting, our backgrounds of our parents. You know, my father was raised on a farm. He was born in a farmhouse in December of 1918.
Was that down in Oklahoma?
In Oklahoma, right outside of Clinton, Oklahoma, which was on Route 66. And grew up on a rented farm. His father paid a percentage of his crop, so he was a sharecropper, basically. And he did other businesses and, you know, whatnot. So he was born the year that World War I ended. He lived through the Dust Bowl, the Depression.
The flu.
The flu was right there when he was born, yeah. You know, in 1918. Then he served in World War II and then went to college and worked for the Soil Conservation Corps, the organization that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, formed in order to address the issues that were caused by the Dust Bowl and prevent those in the future. So my father worked with farmers on soil conservation with his agronomy degree from Oklahoma State, which at that time was Oklahoma A&M.
Sure.
Okay. Have you read Jonathan Rabin's book, Badlands, that it's nonfiction and it relates to the Dust Bowl and that experience?
No, there's another one that I've been wanting to read too. It's from, I can't remember the guy's name. He's works for the New York Times. He's written several books that I like, and it's supposed to be, I think it's called The Dust Bowl or something like that.
Okay.
So it was total land speculation and capitalizing on some times when there was heavy rain and you could grow wheat out there. And so they plowed up this native prairie to grow wheat, and then the rain stopped and there was nothing to hold the soil. And, you know, my father lived, my mother also lived in that area. Her father was a farmer, but not as dedicated. This farm was non-mechanized. They used mules and horses. Now think about the added labor that's involved with that. And then to make money, my grandfather had four or five cows, and they had Matthews Dairy. He'd get up, milk cows, put them in the bottles, put them in a Model T, and deliver them around.
Wow.
I mean, and they lived a pretty good life during the Depression and the Dust Bowl because they could make so much off of their land, you know, to survive. And my dad says, we went every Saturday, had a hamburger, and went to a movie.
High
whole
times.
Family.
Yeah. Now, is this all happening at the same time he is a soil conservation agent?
This is before.
Okay, so prior to.
Yeah, this is all him growing up, you
gotcha.
Know, and then I thought it was interesting that he then went into that profession, you know, after living through it.
Yeah.
And seeing the effects of it, maybe that's what caused it. You know, I don't know.
Right. Let's do the turnabout here, and Ken, something about John here. What is something I wouldn't know, but due to your friendship, you've had a chance to come to appreciate about him?
Well, John likes whiskey.
I do, too.
I do,
for me,
too.
That's the problem.
I do, too. There's
don't
three
we,
of us.
Don't we all?
you know, he likes to taste different ones. John is... I don't think this is something that people would not know about John. Is John's interested in a lot of things. He has the intellectual capacity to go beyond the surface of things. I'm kind of more of I kind of like entertainment and I like the tops of things. I mean, I like getting down in with people, you know, and having real conversations. But I'm not interested in how this computer works or how to fix it. And John can do all sorts of things like that. He can figure things like that out. Maybe people would know that. And that's a lot of things, not just computers. It's just things that...
Thank God for YouTube.
Yeah.
There's a video.
I mean, he can fix cars, stuff that I've never even wanted to do, had any interest in. And he's just good at a lot of things.
I could use some help in my house right now on some projects. Well, you want to come up and do them for me?
Talk to him.
Not even just help me, do them for me.
I'm in recovery.
You know, you probably have seen this too, Ken, with the years of doing the housing report with him, but the guests that come in when we record together, John and I, for Looking Upstream, you know, they come from all kinds of backgrounds and all kinds of stories. And now that you mention it, I've seen that that's true myself, that John can speak to people from any given story or background or historical reference point or whatever they're bringing up. And that is interesting.
And I think
broad knowledge.
John and I'm the same way. We like people. We like knowing about people. We like hearing people's stories. We like telling our own stories.
Just looking for somebody to listen to us.
But, you know, you can go about any place in town and, you know, two of us can strike up a conversation.
I think you're better at that than I am. You know, Ken and I have spent a little time at a local watering hole, which shall remain nameless, but...
Oh, they're a sponsor.
Their initials are Woods. and someone will walk in the door, and they'll just look like they're not from here. They'll have a big belt buckle, or they'll have a cowboy hat, or they're wearing a dress.
Same person?
I would want to know that person if it were the
Absolutely.
Same person.
They've got stories, right?
I want to know their deal.
Ken would turn to them and say, "Where are you from?" And away they'd go. And you go, "Well, I guess I'll talk to his wife because he's been pulled into it." You know, and that's just kind of a native curiosity thing, I suspect. I mean, you're trying to be friendly, but at the same time, you're trying to figure somebody out. And they're always from Texas or Oklahoma if he's lucky.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I think Texas plates and Missouri plates are the two most common out-of-state visitors we have here.
So I don't know about Missouri, but Texas is up there. There's quite a few
Oklahomans,
but not, you know, just like the difference between the two sizes of the two states, the population of the two states, way, way more Texas plates around here, visitors.
Sure. So speaking of curiosity and an interest in kind of digging out things and talking with people, I want to ask about housing too, because it's obviously a big issue, very important one around here and in many places. And the two of you came together. You started Chafee Housing Report. That's several years in existence. Ken, what can you share maybe? I know this is a really broad question, but from the standpoint of the housing crisis and our need for affordability in this particular community.
Housing, just to put it succinctly as I can, housing is the one issue that has the most impact on the health of people. If they don't have secure housing, there's no way they're going to be physically or mentally healthy. And then that rolls downstream. There's studies that have shown that children who move, even if they're in stable families, the more times they move, the less successful they're going to be in school because they have this insecurity, housing insecurity issue that is an overlay. I mean, even though their parents tell them they're going to be fine, it's just a move, that disruption in a child's life is significant. And, I mean, it's not unusual that in this county that the Office of Housing and the Office of Health have collaborated, because that collaboration is a natural collaboration. It's a collaboration that's been I'd say it probably started, how it got started in Colorado was the Colorado Health Foundation made that connection and really published it and put out money for other for counties to apply for and get that money and use it to collaborate on addressing both health and housing at the same time. And Chaffee County was lucky to have Becky Gray and Andrea Carlstrom, who went for that and got that money and have done a lot of education. Well, you're part of that education.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Chaffee County Public Health and Chaffee Housing Authority are who support the show, Looking Upstream. And that's how we came to meet, was because of that. So that sort of transition of sorts from the Chaffee Housing Report, which the two of you have done, to now John and I with We Are Chaffees Looking Upstream, which the way you described it as a social determinant of health and perhaps the most significant one, I don't know if that's backed by the statistics and things, so I'm saying it in a soft way, but it's obviously a very important one.
I think it is probably backed.
I think it probably is, but
I think I'm saying that because Andrea Carlstrom said it.
Which means I should also probably know it, but I was soft-pedaling that for my own grace period there, grace space. And you mentioned before things flow downstream. That's where the name of this podcast comes from, Looking Upstream, is we're trying to get ahead of these issues and speak to some of these social determinants of health. Let me ask you about the housing report and your interest in housing from, I guess, kind of the place I normally ask, which is the human and personal connection to it. What motivated you and that curiosity to care about these housing issues, and in the way that a retired lawyer, a rugby player and coach and all this sort of stuff, like your background wasn't, as I understand it anyway, unless you were in law related to real estate,
no,
it wasn't,
I wasn't
involved in this.
I wasn't. Well, it came from my wife and I came here on our honeymoon. It was a second marriage for me. And we had never been to Salida. We came to Salida and we bought a lot that weekend. We just saw possibility, and this is in 2006. And there were boarded up stores on F Street. And so then we decided we'd build a house here and we would retire here. And then we did that. And then we started seeing that in some ways we were kind of part of the problem. You know, we were bringing an element to Salida that was different than was ingrained in this society. We were newcomers and we had sufficient resources to do what we wanted to do. And there were people who did not have that. And it was very apparent that, you know, when we build our, quote, dream house, that that dream house took resources that could have been building something else. And started meeting people that worked at bars and restaurants and just all walks of life, that it was apparent to me that housing was an issue. And then I got on the board of the Chaffee Housing Trust, which builds affordable housing, and saw how difficult that was to do, and got involved in an organization called the Housing Policy Advisory Committee within the first couple of years I was here, and that was trying to make an impact on housing, because the housing needs assessment had come out and said the same thing that one 5 years ago had said, and nothing had been done in those 5 years. And the Housing Policy Advisory Committee was just ad hoc, just citizens forming it and grabbing county commissioners, pulling them in, city officials pulling them in, and said, well, we need to do something about this. And so it's the first time I had ever had this close connection with the community. You know, Denver, I just worked there, had a clutch of friends, had activities that I was involved in. But as far as, you know, Denver kind of runs itself, but this community needed help.
I'm wondering what the difference is between you being aware of these issues and recognizing I kind of have a role, I can play a different role, I can be active in helping to I don't know, educate, to bring people together, to talk about the issues, to understand what the issues are? What's the difference between somebody like you recognizing that and somebody else who might be a retiree who has resources coming in, being a second homeowner, being, you know, whatever form they take, but kind of staying above the fray, so to speak?
Well, I've always been somebody that's been in the fray, either sports or, you know, I was a trial lawyer, and maybe it's a little bit of ego. I think I can make a difference. You know, there's something about where I've been in my life and what's happened in my life that I think I can make things happen, or at least be part of making things happen. And it's a way bigger job than any one person's ever going to do. So you're just a part of a team. And it just was so clear to me that it was really, in the long run, whether this community survives or fails. And, you know, having adequate housing for people.
John, I want to bring you in to this as well because, again, you were part of Housing Report, and it still is a show that you do just with a little less frequency. Is that right, Ken?
We haven't done it hardly at all. It's just still up on a podcast. I think we got burned out on it. We did it for 6 or 7 years. And, it, you know, my job was to find the people to interview and, you know, allay their fears. You know how that is as an interviewer. People are afraid to do it. Some people are good at it. Some people aren't good at it, and you got to make them feel comfortable. Actually do the research on what their piece of the pie was and come up with questions and send them out to them so they'd be comfortable. And it just started getting to be so hard to find those people, and I'd gotten involved in some other things. I had some health issues, and I just wanted to – I needed to back off.
Okay.
And okay. I have occasionally done some, but very seldom anymore. And I think I wouldn't say the show had run its course. We could have – it's endless issues,
I think probably we had run our course.
Yeah.
I found myself frustrated with the just ponderous slowness of any results. And then I found myself frustrated with how many people were prepared to quietly organize in opposition to any good idea that might be brought forward regarding housing.
Was housing a topic that you had a particular interest in prior to the opportunity to work with Ken for this show? Or is that something that has kind of developed along the several years because you're sitting in the room listening to these people who are the experts, are the leaders, are the idea people talking about it in front of you for years?
Well, I think it developed with guests and with relationship with Ken. But, you know, you were bringing in some county movers and shakers with Phil Weiser, the DA, on. There were people of influence in the chair.
The attorney general.
Yeah.
Phil Weiser.
Yeah, that's the guy. And, you know, these were smart, well-spoken people. But there were also people, I remember one of the last ones we did, we brought in a naysayer. And he and a developer, you know, if they'd been in the same room rather than the same Zoom call, it probably would have come to fisticuffs, and you became aware of how passionate the opposition to, you know, these projects was. I mean, they pull a referendum out of their hat.
And it's easy to do. You know,
you don't need to take
very many.
250.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
You know, you get 250 signatures to protest chocolate ice cream.
It's on the ballot. Yeah. So that was discouraging, I think. And, you know, they continued, correct me if I'm wrong, to try to get the county master plan together.
Yeah, it's been all that's been going. I've kind of lost track of it, but it's been going for years.
Land use,
you know,
plans,
land use plans and master plan, and, you know, those may be done now in the county. I couldn't tell you.
I don't think so. I think I heard Keith Baker talking the other day about how the land use plan was getting there, but not there yet.
The Chaffee County Commissioner.
Yeah.
When is Keith's term up?
November.
With the November election, and then does that happen right away?
No, it goes, I think, goes till the he would be on till the last meeting in that year, and then
okay.
the new electees would come on in January, I think.
Okay. I want to ask one last question here with the time we have, and that is, Ken, you were on the new documentary, A Home in Paradise, which was directed and produced by Julie Spear Jackson, who also recently was on this podcast. Well, one, what was the experience like for you to be in front of the camera, to be somebody who was sought out presumably as one of these voices, a leading voice on this subject in the area?
Well, it's in some ways a highlight of my life to be, you know, recognized as somebody that is worth listening to, you know? And as far as being involved in it, it was easy. You know, it didn't take much time. One of the clips was from a public meeting. I didn't know they were going to be doing that. They just walked up the aisle as I was suggesting that the city might be going to go a different way with the South Arc neighborhood. And, you know, it was fun. It was it felt like a culmination in some ways of the work that I've been doing to educate myself on it and be able to express things in a certain way.
Yeah, so, I could see that. And I think it's a lasting legacy sort of piece in a way that, if you're ready for this, maybe is that cherry on top of all the radio efforts and other efforts that you
put maybe in. So. I was just happy to see it being done. And honored to be part of it.
It's a pretty incredible investment and belief in that possibility. It was Andrea at Chaffee County Public Health and some others on the team that are investing in this idea and saying this is worth doing. And I think it's an amazing piece that speaks to really important topics. And I was grateful to be part of it just a little bit as the narrator as well.
And it's a quality product.
It is.
It's going to be on some public radio, public TV stations, I'm sure, throughout the country.
John, any final thoughts?
You're out of time.
Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the We Are Chaffee Looking Upstream podcast. If our conversation here today sparks curiosity for you, you can learn more in this episode's show notes at wearechaffee.org. If you have comments or know someone in Chaffee County, Colorado, who I should consider talking with on the podcast, you can email us at info@wearechaffee.org. We invite you to rate and review the We Are Chaffee Looking Upstream podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use with that functionality. We also invite you to tell others about the Looking Upstream podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer. John Prey is engineer and producer. Thank you to KHN 106.9 FM, our community radio partner in Salida, Colorado. To Heather Gorby for graphic and web design. To Andrea Carlstrom, director of Chaffee County Public Health and Environment. And to Lisa Martin, community advocacy coordinator for the We Are Chaffee Storytelling Initiative. The We Are Chaffee Looking Upstream podcast is a collaboration with the Chaffee County Department of Public Health and the Chaffee Housing Authority, and it's supported by the Colorado Public Health and Environment Office of Health Disparities. You can learn more about the Looking Upstream podcast and related storytelling initiatives at wearechaffee.org and on Instagram and Facebook at We Are Chaffee. Lastly, until the next episode, as we say here at We Are Chaffee, share stories, make change.